you have them. How's that, Gail? What? How is it in the back? Good? Okay. Well, I don't know this song, so I won't sing it. In fact, I'm the only guy that in my fraternity in college I got fined if I went on the serenades. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and my name's Ron Blue. If I talk funny, it's because I'm from Indiana originally. And when I got to Georgia, I did find that they talked a lot differently down there than what I was used to. In fact, I grew up in a town in Indiana called Lafayette, Indiana. How many of you have heard of Lafayette, Indiana? Everybody. That's where the home of Purdue University. But I wanted to get an education, so I went to Indiana University. Are any Purdue graduates that were here? I said, I've lost one. Well, in Georgia, there's a place called Lafayette, Georgia. And that's the way they pronounce it, Lafayette. And I've had a running battle with my family for a long time on whether it's Lafayette, Georgia or Lafayette, Georgia, spelled the same way. And so we decided to settle the argument one time. We go by Lafayette, Georgia on the way to Lafayette, Indiana, and we've been on that road several times, and we stopped in a Burger King, and I took my whole family in there, and I said to the girl that was at the counter, I said, we're having a little bit of an argument. Can you tell me very slowly where we are? And she said, Burger King. Well, that's not true. But I did grow up in Lafayette. I grew up in a Christian home also and went to Indiana University with one objective in mind, and that was to have a good time. And I did. I got asked to leave school twice to get my act back together, which I did, and Vietnam came along in the mid-60s, and so I hurriedly got back in school to avoid that conflict, and there I met my wife, and that, of course, turns a lot of things around. I graduated from graduate school, and the recruiters, they'd look at my resume, and I had about a 0 point accume through the first 2 years, and had a 4 point the last 2 years, so it averaged out to a 2 point, and then I had a 4 point in graduate school, and they'd say, what happened? You know, where'd you go wrong? And I shared with them that I had gotten a purpose in life and gotten a wife, and when I left Indiana University in 67, I went to work with Pete Marwick Mitchell in New York, because I wanted to go to the biggest CPA firm. Wanted to work in their biggest office. I'd been raised in a Christian home, but that was only until I was 17 and could get away and get on with real life. And I had a goal in life, and that was, as many as you, I'm sure, have had also, and that was to gain as much success as I possibly could, as quickly as I possibly could. That's why I went to New York and was successful in New York. They transferred me to Dallas in a year. Here I was, 23 years old, 1 year out of college, and I had a partner's office in the Dallas office of Pete Marwick, my own private secretary, and partner status, but I'd only been with the firm for 1 year. I was in charge of recruiting for the Southwest area. That was successful. I went to San Francisco a year later to do the same thing, and now I was about 26 and figured what was better than New York, Dallas, and San Francisco, and the only place that I could think of was Indianapolis. So I went to back to Indiana and set up a CPA firm in Indianapolis in 1970, and that grew to 1974. I had about 35 CPAs working for me in three offices in Indiana, and I owned a couple little banks and had achieved really everything in life that I could have hoped for. I had three daughters at that time, and a great marriage, great wife, just bought a new home, belonged to three country clubs, bought my liquor by the case, had two new cars, and I couldn't really think of anything that I was lacking in life. My wife had become a Christian, so she told me, 2 years before, because she'd almost died, and had gotten involved in a Bible study and to find out what had happened had she had died and had committed her life to Christ. And she told me about it. One night, I never forget the night, she said, "What do you think about Jesus Christ?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Well, I've committed my life to him." And I said, "Well, if you have, if that has an impact on your life," I said, "we'll probably have to get a divorce because there's not room for two men in your life, in my life also." And she's not dumb. She didn't mention Jesus Christ again for 2 years. But it was a true 1 Peter 3 experience in that her life was so dramatically different. She was a good person anyway, but there was a quality to it that I couldn't explain away. And I began very quietly to research certain things. I found strange books appearing in our house, the Bible. And began looking at that. And then there was a book that came along called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And I read that through cover to cover. And that had an incredible impact on me because I realized that I wasn't committing intellectual suicide if I became a Christian. And I was understanding now a little bit more about what becoming a Christian was. We went to a Baptist church, only to Sunday school, because I'd never be caught dead in a Baptist church. You know, there was something funny about Baptists. I just knew that. I didn't know what it was, but there was something funny about them. So we'd go to Sunday school, and every Sunday this dentist that was teaching would say, "Now, you're not going to understand what we're going to talk about today unless you're a Christian, because the Bible says the natural man doesn't understand the things of God." And so I'd listen real close. I figured I understood as much as any dentist. I've learned something, Dave, since then. But, so I'd listen real close and paid attention. And one day there appeared a little booklet on my dresser called The Four Spiritual Laws. And I didn't know where it had come from. My wife claims she did not put it there, but I don't believe it. And I picked up that little booklet. I was on my way to play golf. And read through it, understood the whole thing. I understood that I was a sinner and understood that Christ was the provision for sin. I understood that he lived, that he died, and he was resurrected. But I wasn't a Christian because I had never made a commitment of my will to accept that provision that he had made for me. And I understood that clearly, and I wrestled that issue through on the interstate that day on the way to the golf course and finally said, "I really do want to become a Christian." Prayed the prayer that was in that little book, but I put a proviso on there and I said, "God, I'm not going to change anything about my life. Because if you're really real, you'll change me. And if this is all a fraud, then nobody will know the difference." And you know, I got down on the golf course that day and things were the same. I bought a 6-pack of beer to take with me on the front nine. And I shot a 36. That was different. And I won a few bucks, and I said, "Boy, if I'd have known this, I could have made a lot of money a lot earlier." But that day, I stopped swearing. You know, it was one of those things where I didn't try to stop swearing. I just stopped swearing because I no longer could use the name Jesus Christ in profanity. And I had before. In fact, I punctuated probably every other sentence with that name. And I didn't tell anybody what I had done for quite a while. My wife finally realized that there was something different about me. And so I confessed to her what I had done. And my life did change. And I'm going to make a long story short and just say that about a year later, we committed to go do or be whatever God would have us to do. And he took us seriously. I was 34 at the time. And one year later, he really very emphatically called us out of Indianapolis. Or else he delivered us from Indianapolis, I'm not sure which. And we moved to Atlanta, and I joined a ministry called Leadership Dynamics, and I spent 2 years traveling around the world teaching leadership principles to businessmen. Traveled to Africa 11 times, and the reason I relate that to you and related all of this to you is because you need to know where I'm coming from as an individual, because much of what I have to say to you will be opinion based on experience. And on my traveling to Africa, through those trips, I would go there and I would come back and I'd go and I'd come back and I didn't realize what was going on in my life, but in retrospect, I do realize what was going on, and that was that I was seeing something different over there than what I was seeing here. Today, I would probably call that materialism, perhaps, The affluence of the Christian community in this country is unbelievable compared to any place else in the world. And I have a conviction that we are going to stand before the Lord someday and be held accountable as Americans for what we did to fulfill the Great Commission. And one of the ways that we're going to be held accountable is in the use of our money. It's so easy to be a comfortable Christian in the United States. Very few of us, myself included, have ever experienced any type of persecution for the gospel's sake. And I was thinking last night when Walt was talking about self-denial, taking up my cross, the cross being the abuse. Some of us may be in the marketplace, suffer abuse once in a while, not much. None of us have ever suffered really physical loss, other than perhaps physical ailments and death in the family and so forth. But I was seeing something different in the third world than what I was seeing in this country. And it was impacting my thinking, because I kept saying, why is it different? Finally, in 1979, I sat down with Dr. Howard Hendricks to share with him some of the frustration that I was having in the job that I was in. And Howie challenged me. He said, why don't you work with Christians on helping them manage their money? That's something that's of interest to you and something you know a little bit about. And so I decided that I would do that. I had one test, and that one test was if Howie would share with me his personal financial information, he's a very private man, then I would take the next step. And I asked him to send me all of his financial information, which he did, and I prepared a financial plan for him. I started a business called Christian Financial Management in the fall of 1979. The only thing I didn't have was money, a product, clients. And other than that, I was off and running. I want to share just one story with you, and I'll relate back to it later on. When I started that ministry, I really felt like it was something that God wanted me to do. And I felt like the thing that he wanted me to do was to develop a seminar in order to provide a conceptual framework for financial planning. But I didn't have any time to do that. I knew it would take at least 60 days to do it, nor did I have the money. So I went to the bank, borrowed $100,000 on a line of credit, which I had been used to doing with other businessmen and myself. And I kept hearing, Lord said, look, if you want to borrow the money, that's fine, but I'd like to do things my way. I said, Lord, but you don't understand the American economy. This is the way we do things in America. And he kept saying, do you trust me? So I called the bank, canceled the line of credit, because I felt like that he was saying he wanted to do something. Now, I didn't have any money or any source of money at that point. And I knew that he wanted me to do the seminar, and it would take me 60 days to do it. And I said, okay, Lord, I'll do that. I called a hotel in Atlanta, the Radisson Hotel, and I said, I'd like to schedule a seminar for February 9th, which was 60 days down the road. And they said, how many people are coming? I said, I don't have the slightest idea. I don't even know what I'm going to teach. So we eventually agreed on a room for 50 people. And I said, now, one more step, and that was I'm going to call one person, and if they turn me down on the seminar, then I'm going to cancel it, and I'll make a fool out of God or me. And I called this person. I was sure he turned me down. His brother is Bill Brock, the Secretary of Transportation, I think, now. I knew this guy was real busy. So I called him. He said, oh, that's a great idea. I'll come bring my wife and my insurance agent. And I thought, oh, boy, now I'm committed. A week later, I was at Coca-Cola, and the man that I was visiting with there said, what are you doing? And I told him, and he said, have you ever thought about designing a financial planning seminar? And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. He said, would you be willing to do that for Coca-Cola? And I said, well, sure, tell me what you're thinking about. So he went on to describe the seminar that was in my mind. And he said, what would you charge us to do that seminar, to develop it and conduct it? And I said, you mean you pay for those kind of things? And he said, yes, and he figured it up, and he said, well, how would $6,000 be to design that seminar for us? I said, well, that's about the price I had in mind. He said, then we'll pay you $1,000 a time to teach it, and we want you to teach it four times next year. So that's $10,000. And he said, if you wouldn't mind, we'd like to go ahead and send you that check right now so we could get it in this year's budget. I said, that's just fine. Gave him my address. As I was walking out, he said, we only have one problem. I said, what's that? And he said, we have to have the materials ready by February 9th. I said, what a coincidence. Now, I am convinced that had I not taken each one of those steps along the line, God would have never, ever confirmed the ministry, first of all, and shown me that God's ways are different than man's ways. And what we're going to talk about over the next 3 hours or so are some of God's ways of handling money. And what I'd like for you to do is to, as much as possible, take off the filters and listen to me as I speak what I believe is God's word concerning the handling of money. Now, a lot of what I have to say will be opinion, and I'll try to identify it when I say it's opinion. A lot of it is out of the word, and obviously that's not an opinion. I'm reminded of a preacher who one morning got a telephone call from an irate old lady in the congregation. And she was upset. And she said, "Pastor," she said, "you have really let me down." He said, "Well, how did I do that?" She said, "You used the word britches yesterday in your sermon." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry if I offended you." And she said, "That's a terrible word to use." And he said, "Well, ma'am," he said, "do you remember what I said just before I used the word britches?" And she said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, do you remember what I said right after I used the word britches?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, ma'am, if I hadn't used the word britches, you wouldn't have heard anything I said yesterday." So if I say something that you, the red flag comes up, then just remember that's the word britches. And put that aside and listen to what I said before and after, and we'll have time to discuss some things perhaps at a later time. Let me start with an illustration of a man that was my first paying client. He was a physician, is a physician, and I sat down with him in the spring of 1980, and as I sat down with this man, I said, "Tell me what your goals and your dreams are in life." And he shared with me that he wanted to retire as quickly as he possibly could and get onto the mission field full-time. He was 52 years old at the time. His kids were basically raised, they were out of college, and that he had a fairly moderate lifestyle. He was making $85,000 a year. He gave me a net worth statement which showed a net worth of $330,000, which included his home, which I thought was not really very much for a man at that age in his occupation, nor did I think his income was that high for the occupation he was in. His biggest problem was, of course, taxes. He was paying $25,000, $30,000 a year in taxes. He was giving a tithe amount or more. Had been a believer for probably 25 years. Incidentally, I got a letter from this man this week, and one of the people that's had the greatest impact on his life in the last 2 years is Walt Hendrickson. And he shared that with me in a letter. He knew that I was coming here to speak, and Walt was going to be on the program also. And this man is a godly man, a very, very godly man. I got his goals and together and got his financial stuff together, and I said, "Now tell me, if you really had one goal that you would like to accomplish, what would it be?" And he said, "Well, if I really had one goal," he said, "I would like to give $1 million away before I die." I said, "That's impossible, because with that income and with that net worth, there was no way that he could do it." And yet, 60 days later, I called him. I said, "Doc," I said, "we've done the financial analysis, and it looks to me like that you can give away $1 million over the next 5 years, and it looks to me like you'll still have $1 million left when you do that, and you'll be able to retire and go on the mission field at the end of that five-year time period." And he said, "Well, have you been drinking?" I said, "No, I'd given that up some time ago." That was 5 years ago. This man has given pretty close to $1 million away over the five-year time period. He has the option to retire. He's cut back on his workload now about half-time. He's not sure whether he's going to go on the mission field or whether he should stay in the mission field of where he is right now. But the option was there. Now, if I don't forget, I will share with you before we end how this all happened with that man. Typically, I forget, so somebody remind me. But I want you to put yourself in his position, because you're probably in the same position. And yet, if we look at where we are economically in our society, I want to share some facts with you that some of you may know already. These are kind of common in the insurance area, insurance field. But according to the Social Security Board, at age 65, 45% of Americans are dependent upon relatives, 30% are dependent on charity, 23% are still working, and only 2% are self-sustaining. Now, that's a fairly old statistic. I don't know whether it's still true or not, but I do know this, that the percentage of people that are self-sustaining is incredibly low. This was corroborated by Debney's economic tables, which said that fewer men are worth $100 at age 68 than at age 18 after 50 years of hard work, which means that most people don't save $2 per year. And that's the way it would work out mathematically. Also, according to the Social Security Board, 85 out of 100 reaching age 65 don't even have $250. Now, that's an unbelievable statistic. The U.S. Department of Commerce bulletin says the incomes of doctors, lawyers, and most professions on the average start topping out at 47.5 and plunge rapidly after age 54. The reason that's important for you, most of you are professional men, and typically a professional man waits to plan, and when he does, it's too late, in many cases, to do the things that he really wants to do. According to the Atlanta Journal, 11 out of 12 women will become widows. Now, I think that's a little bit high. I think it's more like 70% from other statistics that I've heard. Let's say it's 70% or 11 out of 12. Doesn't make any difference. But the point is, most of your wives will become money managers. And I deal with a lot of those wives that are the product of widowhood or divorce, and they have not been trained to manage money. Reason being that their husbands don't know how to manage money. You know, I'll be honest, that is in fact the case. Incidentally, the average age of the widow in the United States is 52. Think about that. So if your wife is approaching age 52, you better do some short-range planning. You may want to consider a divorce. My wife is very cognizant of that. And lastly, 80% of American families owe more than what they own. Meaning that if you added up their assets and their liabilities, 80% of Americans have more debt than they do assets. I just read on the airplane, I read several economic newsletters. And I suppose I read five or six of them that really went into in-depth analysis of our economy right now, and absolutely every one of them was positive. They all predicted boom, and it scares me to death when that happens. Everybody is saying, you know, buy now because it's only going to get better. In fact, I just picked up Money, or USA Today, the Money section downstairs, looked at the headlines, and it says, even though the Dow is climbing to above 1,700, that there are great bargains in the stock market. So you better get on while the getting's good because you're liable to miss it. Now, which one? Is it going to be prosperity? Or do these facts, are they the ones that are going to control? I believe that what we have going on in people's lives is depicted by this cartoon. And that is that most of us don't know and we're scared to death. We're worried. And there are three questions that cause us to worry. Three questions that we're asking ourselves that we don't have the answer to. Number one, the question is, do I have enough? Now, right now, do I have enough? Have I arrived? By the way, what is enough? Secondly, will I have enough? With college education, I have five children. Will I have enough to fund them? Will I have enough to be financially independent? Will I have enough to ever get out of debt? Will I have enough to start my own business? Will I have enough long term? It's a legitimate question. Thirdly, if I do have enough, and if I do get enough, will it continue to be enough? And that's probably the one that causes us more anxiety than any other. Let me ask a question. How many of you think that inflation is dead? Well, isn't that funny? We are hearing that inflation is destroyed. Nobody believes it. I've asked that question literally to thousands of people, and I have as yet to see one hand go up. As a matter of fact, the inflation rate has not stopped climbing. It just is not climbing as fast. Okay, it's now at 4%, 3 and 4%. You know what the inflation rate was when Dwight Eisenhower left office? Less than 1%, 0.9%. You know what he said the greatest threat facing America was? Inflation. And we had a 1% inflation rate. How many of you feel pretty comfortable with a 4% inflation rate? Everybody. Yeah, I do too. Compared to what it was, I feel pretty good if we can only stay at 4%. And yet, Do you know that the purchasing power of the dollar since 1979, how many can remember 1979? Has gone down 50%? Just since 1979, 50% decline in purchasing power. I was on an airplane some time ago, and I was flying up to the Cove, which is in Charlotte, North Carolina, to speak, and it was one of these commuter airlines, and so we're sitting shoulder to shoulder with people. And I was reading my Bible in preparation for some speaking, and this man that was sitting next to me was also reading a speech that he was going to give, and so it was obvious to each of us what we were going to be doing. So we got to talking, and he asked me where I was going, and I said I was going up to share about the biblical principles of finance. And he said, that sounds interesting. What do you mean? And I said, well, I don't believe that God is surprised by inflation. So I don't think he's concerned about inflation. I think he's not wringing his hands wondering what's going to happen. And I said, the Bible is as relevant today as it was 2,000 years ago. So what the Bible has to say about money management is as relevant today as it was then. And he said, well, what does the Bible have to say about money management? And I said, I think it says four things. I said, number one, the key to financial success, according to the Bible, is these four things. Number one, you have to understand that God owns it all. You can't make any financial decisions that are stewardship decisions unless you understand that God owns it all. Nobody has ever seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul. Naked you came into the world, and naked you're going to go out, and that's a fact. I used to work in a funeral home, and the suits that we put on the dead people didn't have any pockets in them. Dead man doesn't need pockets. And that's exactly the way we're going to go out. We don't need pockets. Secondly, I said, I believe that that the Bible teaches a non-consumptive lifestyle. And by that I mean spending what you can afford or not overspending. I said, I don't know what that means in terms of actual dollars, but a non-consumptive lifestyle, prudence, moderation, that's a biblical principle. I said, thirdly, the Bible discourages but does not prohibit debt. But it discourages debt. And I said, fourthly, the Bible teaches that the guy that has money in the bank or liquidity is better off than the guy that doesn't. So I said, now let's ask ourselves these four questions. Or ask ourselves, or put ourselves into the four economic possibilities. I was sharing this idea of inflation. Be liquid, yeah, was the fourth one. I'm reminded of this cartoon. This lady said, I took your word that the dollar was worthless and got rid of 400 of them today. So be careful what you go back and share. Now I think there are only, I'm not an economist and I'm not a prophet. But I do have some opinions, and I think that there are only four economic possibilities, simplistically perhaps, but only four. Number one, we can continue to have inflation at either rapid or less rapid rate. That's a possibility. Secondly, we can have deflation, which is it's an increase in the purchasing power of the dollar, but it's a decline in values and a decline in prices that people will pay. Thirdly, we can have a monetary collapse, which is a reevaluation of the dollar, and deflation can become that. And fourthly, we can have political upheaval. Now hold those four just a second and think about the four biblical principles of finance: God's ownership, moderate lifestyle, limited debt or no debt, and good liquidity. And ask yourself, what will happen in the event of inflation if you're following those four principles? You answer it. What will happen if we have inflation and you have money in the bank, no debt, a moderate lifestyle, and understand God's ownership? Pardon? You ride with it? That's right. You ride inflation up, right? Well, as a matter of fact, you get wealthier if we have an inflation. How many people would like to have the money to go buy Iowa farmland today? A lot of Iowa farmers would like to buy it if they could just get their others paid off. What happens if we have deflation and you have money in the bank, no debt, moderate lifestyle, and understand God's ownership? You get wealthier. Yeah, your money becomes worth more. Nobody can ever come take anything away from you. And in terms of deflation and a moderate lifestyle, they go hand in hand. You'll probably live a lot better than your neighbor. What happens if we have a monetary collapse and you're following those four principles? At the very worst, you come out relatively the same. Again, nobody can come along and take anything away from you. One of the biggest threats in a monetary collapse or reevaluation is what happens with your debt. Because typically your debt is stayed the same or upped, and the value of what you have in the savings accounts goes down. So nothing bad can happen to you. What happens if we have political upheaval and our government's overthrown, such as what happened in the Philippines this past week? Well, who owns it? God owns it. So again, nothing bad can happen. And if you take those four principles and apply them to the only four possibilities, you see that the Bible really is relevant. Now, what do I think is going to happen? I don't know, to be quite candid with you. But I also, in the long run, don't care. Because I'm not here for the short-term perspective. I'm here for the long-term perspective. And my money is never, ever anything more than a resource. The problem is money becomes the object. And when it becomes the object, you'll never, ever be able to outguess the economic scenario. Now, I could make a great case right now for any one of these four scenarios. I was reading in one of these economic newsletters. I did not know this. But did you know that if the American banks were required to put their balance sheet on a current worth basis, in other words, they valued their loans to the third world properly, they valued their loans to farmers properly, and they valued their loans to businesses properly, you know that the 100 largest banks in America would have a negative net worth? Think about that. The 100 largest, not even one exception in the top 100, would have a negative net worth. Now, what would that do to you? See, that would cause a total monetary collapse or even perhaps a political upheaval. And I don't know whether, in fact, I know our government will not intentionally allow these banks to go out of business. They stepped in Continental Illinois and provided an escape route for them, and they would not allow that to happen. However, there is something else going on that's of concern to all of us. You know that since 1980, our national debt has gone up $1 trillion, it's 100% increase over 1980. It was $1 trillion in 1980, it's over $2 trillion today. $2 trillion. How much is $2 trillion? Let me give you a way to kind of put your hands around $2 trillion. First of all, it's roughly $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. So if I'd have known that, I wouldn't have had five kids. My share of the national debt, then, is $70,000, our family's share. That's one way to look at it. A second way to look at it is that if we decided today that we were going to stop going into debt and begin to repay that debt at the rate of $1 million a day, from now on, when would it be paid back? Roughly 2,000 years from now. Now that's what you call mortgaging your future and your children's future and their children's future. And that's exactly what we have done, is we have pushed the payment back into the future. And the only way out of that I see is probably inflation. We've got to some way inflate it so we pay it back with cheaper dollars. Now let me tell you what I think is going to happen. This is a layman's viewpoint. And it comes from listening and thinking. I was meditating one day and I said, Lord, we give counsel to a lot of people. What do I tell them is going to happen in our economy? Because I don't know. And I believe that this is a possibility. Number one, the basic nature of man is selfish. When you put a selfish man in our type of economy, which has almost unlimited productivity, there's only one result. You know what that is? Selfish man, take a selfish man and put him in a shopping mall. What happens? Greed. I mean, it's like fanning the flame. In our supermarket alone, there are 30,000 spending decision alternatives, let alone a mall, hundreds of thousands. And you take a selfish man and put him into that type of environment, and there's one result, and that's greed. I'm talking about the natural man now. And we can look around and see it. You know, the bumper sticker that you've seen, whoever dies with the most toys wins. That's what they're saying. And, well, I get off on now and start preaching. If you take greed, now take this, selfishness plus unlimited productivity equals greed. Second equation, greed plus debt, which is the unlimited ability to fund greed. All right? That's exactly what it is. How many of you have ever gotten an application for a credit card that you didn't ask for? Sure. We have redefined in America being able to afford it. I mean, literally have redefined it. Being able to afford it has nothing to do with the cost of anything. Being able to afford it has everything to do with the payments. That's how we define being able to afford a car, being able to afford a house, being able to afford a vacation, being able to afford furniture, being able to afford TVs. Anything is, can I afford the payments? Right now, the consumer debt, this is not mortgage debt, this is not business debt, this is not investment debt, strictly consumer debt to buy depreciating items, is 20% of the after-tax income of all Americans. 20%. And there's more capacity there. A lot more capacity. You know how we get that capacity? We just extend the payment out. 2,000 years now, we're talking about in the national debt. And it works for an individual the same way. Some of you might be able to remember at least stories about what was the length of a mortgage, say, in 1945. How long would a bank lend money for? 10 or 12 years. How much would they loan on a home? 50%. What will they loan today? 100% for how long? 30 years, and they'll go 50 years if you need it, in order to make the payments affordable. So I think that if you take greed plus the unlimited ability to fund that greed, you only have one consequence to that, and that's called inflation. Why? Because the price is no longer has any relevance. What it costs is no longer relevant. And so we can raise the prices. This is what has stimulated our economy. We can raise the prices because it will not inhibit buying. Now, if you take inflation, the third equation is inflation plus time equals what? A monetary collapse, a revaluation, political upheaval. It has to, because ultimately the value of our currency becomes worthless. And we have to blow the whistle on Sunday night. Monday morning we wake up with something new in terms of a currency. That's the peaceful way that it'll happen, such as it happened in Israel. Now, I don't know for a fact that that's going to happen or when it's going to happen, and frankly, I don't care if it's going to happen. What I wanted to do up until this time was to provide a context, an economic context that we're living in. Now I want to share with you some of the things that God's Word has to say, and I would like to have you open your Bibles. Yes. Those three what? Yes. Selfishness plus productivity equals greed. Greed plus debt equals inflation. Inflation plus time equals monetary collapse. Now, I think that as a Christian, this is what is typically happening. We are retreating to the North Georgia Mountains or to the Rocky Mountains. And we're saying, I don't know what's going to happen, I just know that it can't be good, and therefore I'm going to withdraw. And yet God calls us to be three things in the Scriptures. More than that, but at least three things. Number one, He calls me, according to Matthew 5, verses 13 to 16, to be salt and light. Now, salt and light, Matthew 5, verses 13 to 16. Salt and light, let me give you a layman's definition of that. That's being different. Not better, but different. The Christian lifestyle is not better than, but it's different from. The Christian lifestyle, for example, is different from because it's free from worry or anxiety. Yes, these things are probably going to happen. Yes, we're going to have inflation, and there's nothing, incidentally, that you or I can do about it, except live within that type of society and economic environment. So what am I called to be? I'm called to be different. Not better, but different. So could the world look at you and I and see anything different? Because if they can't, they don't have any hope. Because they don't have any more answers than you or I do. Secondly, according to Mark 10, verse 45, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Matthew 6, verses 19 to 24. You cannot serve, same word, God and money. I always thought, why didn't he give me a third choice? But he gave me two choices. He says, you cannot serve God and money. Why not? Why isn't there another choice? Well, I believe it's this, that money represents everything that God is to me. Why? Well, if I have money, I can have friends, acceptance, and self-worth. If I have money, I'm a successful person, I have a good self-image. If I have money, I can buy forgiveness in many cases, which God offers to me. I can buy almost anything in terms of what God will provide me for free if I have money. So if I serve money, what I am doing is putting it in the place of God. Now, I believe you can use money in an incredible way to serve God, and we're going to talk about that through the rest of the morning session. In fact, I get excited about the potential that's right here. There may be more potential right here, or enough potential right here to fulfill the Great Commission in the United States, let alone the world. I know this, that in the Southern Baptist denomination alone, if the Southern Baptist alone gave $100 to foreign missions per year, there'd be $1.4 billion a year going to foreign missions, which would probably be enough to fulfill the Great Commission. Resources is not the problem. Never, and not in our economy. Thirdly, we are called to be a steward. Probably the classic case of a steward is a banker. Now, let's open to Matthew chapter 25 and look at the parable of the talents. Matthew chapter 25, that's on page 1162. And I'm reading out of the New International Version. Beginning in verse 14, the context of this parable, which incidentally is not a money management parable, this parable is talking about the return of Christ. The disciples have asked him, what's the kingdom of heaven going to be like? When are you going to be coming back? And he is reciting several parables in this portion of Scripture. And this is just one parable that illustrates. There are many, many principles in here that can be applied to various situations, and we're going to apply to money management principles because they're true. Verse 14, again, it, meaning what he's talking about, the kingdom of heaven, will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. Principle number one of stewardship. I'm going to give you four principles of stewardship. Principle number one is God owns it all. He entrusted his property to them. Now, if I ask you to raise your hand and say, how many believe that God owns it all? Probably 90 to 100% of the hands would go up. You all believe that God owns it all, and I believe that God owns it all. Well, what are the implications of believing that? And I think there are three implications to believing that God owns it all. Implication number one is I hold everything with an open hand because he can take whatever he wants whenever he wants it. If God owns it all, whatever I hold, it's in his property, he may take whatever he wants. Or he may entrust whatever he wants to entrust. Somebody asked me one time, how much is too much? And I think too much is when I begin to go like that. When I begin to close over what he's entrusted me with, I have too much. I need to pry him loose again and let him take whatever he wants, whenever he wants it. And if you believe that God owns it all, you could close your eyes right now and let him take, picture him taking that Mercedes, or that Rolex watch, or that home, or that vacation home, or that favorite suit of clothes. Whatever it may be, all of us have different things that turn us on and that really grab us. Mine's like most of yours, it's cars. You know, he can take my car whenever he wants, for whatever purpose he wants, because he owns it all. It's all his. And once I understand that, then I'm free to manage his resources. And that's an implication of God owning it all. We just moved into a new and larger home. And when I understood that I was free to make the move was when I realized it didn't make any difference to me whether I did move or not. If the deal fell all the way through, then I realized I really think I do now have a perspective, at least in the home situation, on God's ownership. And whether if he wants to entrust it to me, fine. If he doesn't, fine. The second implication of God owning it all is every spending decision, therefore, is a spiritual decision. Now that is, you want to talk about something impacting your thinking. Open your checkbook and go through your checkbook line by line and say, God, I used your resources in this way in order to accomplish your purposes. Because if God owns it all, then your checkbook is a written testimony of your stewardship. Now that's a hard, hard saying, but I believe it's the truth. Wouldn't it be something if when we get to heaven we have to take our checkbooks? We got all eternity to go through all those check stubs. And we sit down with the Lord and say, well, Lord, I used your money in this way. And I used your money in this way. And I used your money in this way. Think about that. Now, that I'm not trying to put a guilt trip on you. I may be. But I am trying to ignite conviction. Because let's look at the positive side of that. If I realize that every spending decision is a spiritual decision, then is it more spiritual to give or to take a vacation? Which one's more spiritual? Which one's going to get more credit in the kingdom? Neither. God owns it all. God has a plan and purpose for my life. Money is a resource to accomplish God's plans and purposes. Perhaps it's spending money to take a vacation. Why? Not because of the vacation, but because of the other things that God would have you to do in your family's life. Now, I'm not looking at a rationalization there. I'm saying because the process we're going to talk about later. But there is a process to going to determining, is this God's will? But if I understand that God owns it all, then every spending decision is a spiritual decision, and I am free then to use his resources to accomplish his plans and purposes, and nothing is more or less spiritual in terms of the use of money. Thirdly, you can't fake stewardship. It's the one area of the Christian life that cannot be faked. You can fake prayer. You can fake quiet times. You can fake Bible memory. You can fake going to church. You can fake every aspect of the Christian life. But you can't fake stewardship because your checkbook reveals your stewardship. And again, sit down with your checkbook and say, Lord, how am I doing with your resources? Those are heavy thoughts. I believe to wrap up the issue of God owning it all, think of it this way. God, or the owner has rights, a steward has responsibilities. An owner has rights, a steward has responsibilities. A steward never has rights. Therefore, if that banker determined that he liked my money so well that he was going to take a trip to France, how would I feel about it? I wouldn't like it. because a steward has responsibilities to handle somebody else's resources to accomplish their purposes. And that's the essence of stewardship. God owns it all, therefore I am a manager of His resources. And we can give glib lip service to that, but the reality is your checkbook reveals your stewardship. Well, this is getting pretty convicting, so let's move on. To the one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. To make money? No, to be faithful, as you would see later on in this passage. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. Listen, he knew whose money it was. Didn't he? It said he hid his master's money. No question about whose money it was in any one of their minds. After a long time, we could ask the question, when is Jesus coming back? Don't know. It could be this morning. Could be 1,000 years from now. The point is, he is coming back. The master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. And I believe that's important. I do believe that there will be an accounting done at some point. The man who had received the 5 talents brought the other 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Principle number 2. Principle number 1, God owns it all. Principle number 2, we are in a growth process. That's revealed throughout Scripture. And God uses money in that growth process, I believe, as a tool, a test, and a testimony. A tool to grow me up, a test of my faithfulness, and a testimony to the world. It says, you have been faithful with a few things. Now I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. What we're doing here has eternal consequence. And how I handle my money today has eternal consequence. How I handle every area of my Christian life has eternal consequence. We just happen to be talking about the money side, but how I handle his property, I believe, has eternal consequence. And I'm going to give you an illustration when we close this morning that I think will blow your mind when you put the temporal perspective into the eternal perspective and see the difference in the way we handle money and what the impact can be. So we are in a growth process, and God uses money as a tool, a test, and a testimony. Then let's go on. Verse 22, the man with the 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I've gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. In most versions of the Bible, if you would look at verse 21 and verse 23, what difference would you see? None. That's right, there is none. And yet, one had 2.5 times more than the other one did. So I can draw a principle from that too. And the principle is this, the amount is not important. But the attitude is, the amount is not important, but the attitude is determinative. So whether or not I have a little bit or a whole bunch, it doesn't make any difference. I'm still a steward over whatever I have. I will not be a steward when I have more. Now again, we're breaking out of this whole habit, this whole idea that there's God's portion and my portion. How much does he own? All of it. 100%. Absolutely everything, and you have to understand that. Now let's go on. Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid. What was he afraid of? Double-digit inflation, perhaps. A monetary collapse, perhaps. I don't know what he was afraid of. Maybe he was afraid that the master was going to come back. That's possible. But he said, I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. He understood the issue of ownership. But he didn't do anything. And that's the fourth principle. Faith requires action. In other words, understanding that Jesus was raised from the dead means nothing. Even the devils believe that. But what has to happen? Faith requires action. James 2, verse 17. Faith is an action verb. And even though I know, but what am I going to do about it? Knowing is not enough. I have to do something as a response. I have to act on the basis of what I believe. And let me give you in closing a definition of stewardship. Stewardship is the use. And that's a word, use. That's not a belief. That's a use of God-given resources for the accomplishment of God-given goals. How many of you brought any resources into this world? No one. So where did they come from? All of them came from God. So I use His resources to accomplish His goals. His resources, His goals. A fellow named William Cook wrote a book called Success, Motivation, and the Scriptures. And he defines success as the continued achievement of God-given goals. So that if I'm continually achieving God-given goals, when I stand before Him, what am I going to hear Him say? Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with just a few things. Now I'm going to put you in charge of many things. Come and enter into my joy. And that's what stewardship is all about, using His resources to accomplish His purpose for an eternal consequence. And when we come back after our break, we're going to get into some application of how do I take what I have or what He has entrusted me with and use it for His purposes. We have a break now, don't we? Okay, third principle, the amount is not important. The amount is not important. Winston, is this the break time? Is it? Okay, I didn't know.